helping students and parents prepare for a school year without precedent. It is back to school time, but for most students across the state, it is not exactly a normal start to the year. School districts have been spending the summer coming up with new plans and backup plans and schedules and policies. Of course, they are all trying to figure out a safe way to keep kids engaged in learning during the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will get some guidance from experts, tips on navigating the many challenges kids and their families will face, from physical distancing and wearing a mask all day to coping with anxiety and fear. How can kids learn when almost everything has changed? How is it different for younger students and high schoolers? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Many students in Maine are going back to school this week. Today, we will talk about the difficulties of returning to school in the midst of a pandemic, and we'll hear some tips and techniques for how to navigate those challenges. Joining me, Chris McLaughlin. He is Associate Vice President of Community and Pediatric Services at Northern Light Acadia Hospital. And Bear Shea, he's the Mental Health and School Counseling Specialist with the Maine Department of Education. As always, we want to hear from you. Is your child anxious about all the changes at school? Are you worried about how it will work to combine remote learning with being in the classroom? Are you worried about fearfulness for your children? You can ask a question by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Make it brief, please. talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us today for this hour. And Chris, for many kids in Maine, today's the first day of school. For others, it's next Tuesday. We're going to talk with the many challenges that students will face as school starts. But the overarching challenge is simply dealing with so much change. Can you talk about how kids are affected by having to deal with so many changes at once?
Sure. And I just want to say hello and thanks for having me on today. You know, it's going to be a year of unknowns, a year of firsts, thinking about how schools ended in the spring compared to how they're starting in the fall are very different. And so I think for me, it's really about making sure that kids and families and educators have such an open line of communication, that we're just constantly talking to each other, right? That we're not letting too much time go by without checking in, without sharing new information, without answering questions and as honestly and transparently as we can that kids may have and bring to us.
Bear, are there basic techniques for dealing with the start of the school jitters that apply even more now that the start of school may be so unusual?
Well, I think one thing we can do at home is certainly talk about it and have those conversations. You know, I think sort of normalize it much as we would going back to school, you know, every year. There's always that bit of anxiety coming in. And I think just talking about that, exploring it, making sure that our children have the information about what's going to happen when they're at school so that they can be prepared so that it doesn't catch them off guard. I know a number of parents have been trying to have students wear masks and practice that, so the tolerance for mask wearing is up. And I know teachers are really looking at kind of using those same skills that they use every year for creating norms in the classroom, and safety and security, and really using relationship as a primary way of protecting students from that new anxiety.
Bear, why don't you give us some language, especially for younger children? How would you be talking to a kindergartner, first or second grader right now about their jitters?
I think some of it can be as simple as acknowledging that it's kind of funny or strange. You know, this is something that we have been doing for a little while, but it's also not normal, right? We're still in a crisis. This is something that's still actively going on. And so I think just acknowledging that, like, yeah, it's strange to wear our masks to school, to places where we haven't before. It feels, you know, it feels funny. but we're doing this because we're keeping people safe, because we want to keep our friends safe and our family safe. So I think really sort of normalizing it in that sense, using simple words, using caring words, talking about us providing safety for students. And really that's a key piece, is that we're protecting them as well.
Chris, what if you as a parent are feeling fearful yourself? What kind of advice do you have about sharing? Do you share your fears with your kids, or do you sort of keep those in another room and put on a brave face for your kids?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I'm talking with so many families right now who are just trying to figure out how to manage themselves, let alone the little kids around, and making sure that they're just being aware of kid ears in rooms. You know, it's such a fine line for families to be transparent, to be honest and open, and to be able to share your feelings without oversharing or adding to those feelings of anxiety. It's so important, and I think Bear hit the nail on the head. It really is about, kids need to know that the grown-ups have got this, that we are here, we're keeping them safe, we're not going to let bad things happen. And so I think just managing those emotions, finding who your sounding board is, who you feel comfortable just kind of letting it all go and airing it all out, and just saying, you know, I'm terrified of what's coming, but not necessarily saying I'm terrified to your grade schooler.
Bear, I want to ask you, I read this morning that sort of there's a sweet spot as far as kids doing what they're told and actually washing their hands and wearing masks and standing in line and social distancing. And that sweet spot is about second grade to about eighth grade. One, do you agree with that? And two, if that's true, what about ninth through 12th grade? How do we get teenagers on board?
I mean, I think compliance is going to be difficult and look different at all ages. You know, we're really going to see, different ways that works. And a lot of that is really going to come down to creating those norms, creating that safety, really looking at it as a community issue rather than even just a classroom issue. And so I think that's a big piece. And I think that's another thing to recognize, is that our adolescents and our young adults, they see this pandemic in a very different way than younger children. And part of that sort of need to share their information and their impact is something that we should be taking advantage of and really including them in how we're building safety and security for our schools. And so I think inviting some of that that conflict and challenge, I think, can be really healthy and be a great way to get them on board with, you know, why we're doing things the way we are, and how they can be included in that safety.
Bear, tell me what you mean by that. How are teenagers seeing this differently than younger children?
Well, I think that, when we talk about engaging younger children, we really do talk about that providing safety and letting them know that we're there to protect them. You know, as we move into that sort of young adult, there's that natural space of stepping away from adults and saying, I don't need you to protect me. I can figure it out on my own. We know that as parents, we still want to provide that safety and guidance for our youth and adolescents. And it's also a really good opportunity to bring them into that fold and showing them the bigger world, that there are things that, you know, do need, sort of more consideration and more awareness than they had when they were younger. And so I think bringing them into that in an appropriate way really gives them some buy-in, gives them some power, and sort of allows them to access the adult world in a way that can be really helpful and supportive for the community.
Bear, talk to me about preparing kids for a scenario in which everything might change. You know, telling them, for example, in your school district, you're going to go to school every other day, and then every other day you're going to be online, but that might change. How do you not only prepare children for something that's so unusual, but then for the likelihood or possibility that it may be temporary?
It's one of the interesting things that, you know, for all brains, change is difficult and can feel risky. Our human brains just don't like change very much. However, really, young children are much better at handling change. By and large, their brains are far more flexible. And having those norms and security, that feeling of safety within a community, really can make it so that any of those changes that happen can sort of be weathered. As adults, we actually have more difficulty with change. And I think for a lot of us, it's really difficult to imagine what this would be like for kids and how scary it is. And while that's true, there's also a part of, you know, these are things that kids do all the time. Their plans change, their situations change, their interactions with each other change. They're much more flux than, you know, we are as adults. And so when they have the safety and security, when they can look to adults around them and to systems and securities that provide that, they'll weather this change and they'll weather these shifts. And so really it's kind of going back to that, how do we provide that larger context of safety?
You know, it's interesting you said that. As I was reading up on some articles this morning, I was thinking, but aren't kids generally more resilient than adults? And you're saying yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you took the words right out of my mouth, Jennifer. Really what you're talking about is resiliency. And there are ways that families and teachers and educators can be working on those resiliency skills now, starting to lay that foundation of setting up kids for success so that when times get tougher, they're going to be able to pick themselves up, dust off a little bit easier, and move forward.
Hmm. And that's one of the things we've been really looking at the DOE is providing, you know, some of that content area support. But really, it's relying on the skills that the teachers already use every single fall. You know, this is something we do. We renormalize all sorts of things. You know, we haven't seen kids for months, and we're bringing them back into possibly a whole new classroom setting with new teachers and new responsibilities and expectations. So teachers, this is something they do really well. So it's you know, sort of and there's more to it maybe this year. But with those structures and systems in place, that consistency, you know, working through the masks and all the other pieces are really part of what they already do so well.
We're talking about getting kids ready to go back to school. Also, maybe getting your family ready for this unusual year. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. Several weeks ago, Chris, we did a whole program on grief and the pandemic and that it's okay to grieve, even if you sit there and you think to yourself, wow, I have so much. How come I'm feeling grief for the loss of seeing my coworkers or the loss of not being able to go to a restaurant? Doesn't that seem shallow? And we were told by experts that it's okay to feel that grief. I'm imagining that many kids, especially many high school students, are going to feel that if they're not able to play their fall sport or be in a theater production or play in the band room that where the kids are always crowded and there's not a lot of ventilation. How do you help kids deal with the disappointment of not being able to do that thing that they've been looking forward to and which binds them to their friends?
Yeah, and I would say it's even more complicated than that, Jennifer, because we're working with kids coming to us this fall with the grief of the spring, of how the school year ended and school prom and dances and graduation and field days all canceled, plus who knows what's happened over the summer in terms of family vacations and being able to do those family trips or family gatherings that also may have been canceled. So really what I think for me, one of the most unfortunate parts of all this is this complicated grief on top of grief on top of grief. And I've been spending a lot of time with schools and districts and families about reminding folks of those stages of grief and finding a common language to talk about the anger or the denial or the depression that comes with feeling grief. And I love the idea of creating some kind of rituals to help kids adjust to or really just start processing through some of that grief. I've talked with some teachers who are going to plant gardens this fall and are doing a time capsule of the coronavirus and having kids bring in their canceled airline tickets or concert tickets or things like that that they can tuck in this time capsule and put it away and sit with it. I think part of what we as a society don't do well is sit with grief. And we're constantly trying to distract ourselves or try to figure out how to get over it. And the longer we can spend just dedicating time to feeling it and then do some kind of ritual to help process it and then move on from it.
Bear, I want to talk to you about just the whole idea of learning with masks on. So much of learning is speaking, facial expressions. Communication is so dependent on looking at one another, not only for people with hearing loss, but for all of us. Any of us who's had experience of trying to talk to the bank teller at the drive-in window, or even talk to a receptionist at the doctor's office, can understand how difficult it is to communicate with a mask on. What is your advice for students and teachers, and how to do that?
Yeah, it is one of the, you know, the biggest obstacles, really, is not only just the wearing of the mask, but that it really occludes half of our face and where a lot of our information comes from. Even if we are primary English speakers, you know, we get all of the information from reading someone's lips. And so there's a lot of loss there. I think some of the advantages is that, you know, really looking at how we express and how we do. I think sometimes we forget that our faces are as integral as they are. And, you know, anyone who's sat through a monotone lecture, we can see somebody's face, but it's still not engaging. And so how are we using our bodies? How are we using the rest of our face as an expression device? I've talked with teachers about practicing talking in front of mirrors and really making their, you know, sort of using different muscles in their face to really highlight emotion. I think another really important part is when we're talking about working with students, really building new ways of showing that we care and showing that we are engaged, making sure that a lot of the normal interactions we have, we take for granted. And now we can't do a lot of those. We can't use some of our facial expressions to indicate, you know, pleasure or pain. They're hard to read. And some of the normal interactions we have, like even a hug, is something that we can't do right now. And so I know we've been talking with teachers about really intentionally building in new rituals for showing that we care, for showing that we're connected, to say, hey, when I do this, it means that, hey, I'm connecting with you. I'm showing that I care, even though, you know, we can't see it in the way that we normally would. So I think there's a lot of ways to bridge those gaps. And I know teachers are experimenting constantly on making that connection through the mask.
And Chris, I'm wondering if you have anything to add about just getting kids to wear their masks all day.
Yeah, it's probably the topic we're spending the most amount of time talking with teachers and families about it. You know, my hope is that, you know, families were doing some practicing over the summer and building up some tolerance, increasing, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. We've been using what I call the three P's of practicing, playing, and pretending, and making sure that at this point, kids should know what mask fits them well. Parents should know what mask fits well. Not every kid's going to do well with a paper disposable scrunchy mask. And even using familiar material like an old teddy bear or stuffed animal, an old blanket, old T-shirts, things that they're familiar with. And then for younger kids, I like the pretending piece to this, where they're playing fashion show, they're doing dress up, they're doing doctors and nurses and veterinarians with their stuffed animals at home. Masks need to be everywhere right now. And it's this line of, as Bear said, there's so much not normal about this. And we've got to try to normalize it for the here and now. So if the mask is something that's crumpled up in your pocket and you only take it out and you grumble when you put it on, it's not going to surprise us when kids have that same or similar experience or reaction to masks. So we've got to just be doing this, keeping masks in the car, on the bedstand, in the dining room, on the table, on the coffee table, and then having fun with them, laughing with them. So having your friends and family members from all over the country send selfies and create a mask photo album. We've also been, similar to what Bear was saying, really working on that eye language piece to help kids recognize what different eye expressions may mean. And so putting that mask on and just playing with the face and playing with your eyes and seeing if kids can identify different feelings on just the eyes alone.
What fun. And that sounds like a fun thing to do, too, maybe at the dinner table or maybe after one's eaten. You can't really eat it with the mask on. Right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about getting kids ready to go back to school in the midst of a pandemic. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Andrew Scoggin Home Health Care and Hospice, providing home care, hospice, and palliative care, and now telehealth, andrewscoggin.org, and the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu.
The Postal Service provided a path into the middle class for generations of Black Americans.
I was able to help pay for my son's college education, provide a good middle class lifestyle for us, and to know that I would have my retirement taken care of.
Why advocates fear cost-cutting measures could disrupt that path, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
So what makes Maine really special, and this is something that I've learned throughout me being from Brunswick, but then going to Bowdoin, where we have these different people coming from all different backgrounds, but still within Brunswick, is that Mainers, you talk about Southern hospitality, but really you have Maine hospitality, where we're just so ready to help other people. We have this huge resource, we're over 89% forest. We have Katahdin Waters within Baxter State Park. We have Acadia, we have Tumbledown, we have Camden, we have Rockport, we have all of this ocean coastline. To me, it means access. My name is Sean Baird, I'm from Brunswick, Maine, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how to navigate the many challenges of going back to school. Joining me, Bear Shea, who is mental health and school counseling specialist with the Maine Department of Education, and Chris McLaughlin, associate vice president of Community and Pediatric Services at Northern Light Acadia Hospital. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And a note, this show is part of Maine Public's ongoing deep dive coronavirus coverage with a focus on education. You can find out more about our series on how public schools in Maine are preparing to reopen this fall by going to mainepublic.org/coronavirus. Calling in now, Maggie Bordeaux, who is the lead pediatrician with Southern Maine Healthcare. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Bordeaux.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us some more about masks. I think a lot of people are concerned with masks and breathing. Can it be harmful for kids breathing to have their faces covered all day?
Yeah, good question. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children who are over 2 years old can safely wear a mask. And so for those children, it does not impair their breathing on a regular basis. For the children under 2 years old, there is risk there. And so it's better for them to be unmasked. But sitting for a long time period with a mask on should not cause any problems with lung functioning or retention of carbon dioxide. And it really, they allow oxygen to get through in an adequate amount.
People say that the trinity here for stopping the coronavirus is the mask wearing, the social distancing, and the hand washing. We've talked about masks, but I want to ask you about the others. Is it realistic to expect adequate hand washing and physical distancing in schools, enough to create a safe environment for students and staff?
Well, with going back to school this year, the good news is that kids have heard a lot about this already. They've heard it from their parents. They've heard it when they're out on the playground, and they've watched it happen in their communities. So they do have some experience with it so far. Now, the good news is that kids are playful, and as one of your previous guests said, they are malleable. So they accept change and they listen to rules, particularly in the school environment. So that should help somewhat with physical distancing. It is hard for the younger kids because they want to be with their friends, they want to hug their friends, and that's where it's really important for parents to talk to their children before they go back to school about what's responsible for meeting up with their friends that they haven't seen for 6 to 8 months now, and you know how they should approach them, what kind of closeness that they can have. The other piece about hand hygiene is a little bit easier to answer because parents are really good at that piece already. Basically, before children eat, they wash their hands. That's common at home. And now parents, again, have been doing that. And there's been hand sanitizer at public places, parks, restaurants, stores. So kids are getting used to that. And so I think it's becoming easier to direct them. And again, parents can play a big role there by just reminding them when they come home after a school day, it's really important that the first thing they do when they walk through the door is to wash their hands.
Many people believe kids are not likely to get the coronavirus, and if they do, it would be mild or asymptomatic. What can you tell us about infection rates for kids, and what do parents and caregivers need to know in order to stay vigilant?
Right. So I think that I want to answer the second half of the question first, because I think this is really important for parents because it's different than the other years where kids went back to school. So probably in the past, if a child had a little bit of a runny nose but was otherwise acting well, parents would say, okay, you know, here's your tissues, and they would send them off to school. But this year, we want parents to really be mindful of what their child looks like in the morning before they send them off. So they want to make sure if the child just doesn't look well, that they really think about that, and it's better to keep those kids home and call the pediatrician or call the school and talk to them about any symptoms that the parents are seeing before they send them. Because the coronavirus is really difficult to distinguish from other illnesses, particularly in kids, because it comes with cough, fever, sore throat, and a myriad of other symptoms, which can be very easily confused with many other illnesses like influenza, a common cold, strep throat, any of those things. So it's really difficult to tell. So we encourage parents to communicate with their children's doctors about any symptoms that they're concerned about, and just keep them home and talk to somebody before they send them back to school. In terms of if children can get coronavirus, they can. But again, their symptoms seem to be much more mild than adult symptoms are. And again, look very similar to other illnesses that children usually get in the wintertime.
Dr. Bordeaux, before we let you go, I'm going to read to you an email from Scotty, who writes, kids can use a face shield rather than a mask. It's much more normal. What's your response to Scotty?
So there's still emerging data coming out around face shields versus face masks. And it looks like right now that face masks are the safest thing for children to use and adults to prevent any spread of infection. However, face shields are likely kind of the second step below that, meaning that they're better than not wearing anything at all. The advantage for face shields is that, as one of your other guests was talking about, it does allow for people to interpret face expressions better and sometimes the language in terms of the way that teachers are moving their mouths and using words. That's somewhat easier for children to understand. However, it's just safer to have the cloth face masks.
All right. Well, Dr. Maggie Bordeaux, lead pediatrician with Southern Maine Healthcare, thanks so much for calling in to Maine Calling today. And joining us now is Erin Frazier with the Maine Department of Education. She is State Director of Special Services, Birth to 20. Thanks for calling in, Erin.
Thank you for having me.
With all the challenges happening, I imagine it is even harder for many students who receive special services. And we were just talking about masks. Are special ed students sometimes not able to wear face coverings? And are they more affected by teachers having masks on?
You know, we've been talking a lot about masks here at the department, and we've been working with stakeholder groups, including parent groups, Autism Society for Maine, and pediatricians to understand really how we can support all students in wearing face masks during this time. But we do understand that it's a skill that you have to practice and you have to learn, and that some children are going to have a really hard time with it. So as an accommodation, some children will be able to wear a face shield while they're in training to wear a face mask, or as just a general accommodation because they can't tolerate a face covering. But we think that most children are going to be able to wear a face mask with the proper support.
I want to read to you a Facebook post that came in just a few minutes ago. This is John. He writes, our adult son has autism, and if there's one thing that rattles him, it's a change of routine. Well, everything has been a change of routine since March, when his favorite places, for example, the public library, closed in March, we told him, quote, a lot of people are sick and the library is closed, so more people don't get sick. He understood that concept. To this day, 5 months later, whenever he has to do something unusual, like wear a mask or wait in line with the 6 foot distance, he says, I know, it's the sickness. That's his understanding, and he hangs on to it. Sometimes he will ask, are the people better? Meaning, are all those people with COVID-19 better now? And can we go back to the normal way? We say, sorry, no, the people are still sick. Believe me, we look forward to the day when we can say, yes, the people are better. And I'm wondering, after listening to John's Facebook post, how you would use what he's saying to talk to, he says his son is an adult, to talk to maybe students with autism who are a little bit younger.
Well, we certainly know that there's been a lot of social stories that have come out for children with autism, and it's just general teaching for children to understand and to be taught about the expectation that people are going to look different. And as special educators in the field, people are working on making children at ease with that. Maybe they're wearing a button with their face on it. Maybe they're starting with a clear face shield. But we certainly have to retrain and build a new understanding of that things are going to be different at school. And you're right, for people with autism, changing routines can be really traumatic and challenging, but they can be taught and they can learn. And that's a perfect way of doing it, is to just talk about the social story of what happens when people are sick. So it is a change. I think everybody's experiencing the change. Like your previous caller said, a lot of children in the community that I see are already practiced with wearing face masks. And I know that groups that support students with autism have, and myself included, have been putting resources out for parents around providing social stories for mask wearing and why it's happening and what's happening in our community. Maine Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing put out a great video for children explaining the coronavirus and how it was impacting and what would happen. And so that kind of thing really supports and helps children. And it does take time to adjust. And I know there's going to be a lot of children who come into school this year and find it very different. But all children can learn. We believe that. And we think that, you know, as long as we have these supports in place, they'll be able to make good progress from their educational program.
Finally, Aaron, I read there may be increased risk for getting COVID-19 among people who have intellectual or developmental disabilities. Is this a concern for having these students in the classroom?
You know, I can't speak to if there's an increased risk because I'm not a doctor. I assume that everybody's at risk, and we are planning accordingly for that through the mask wearing and social distancing. And if a child can't tolerate a mask, we would teach them how to do that safely before they could be around other students. So I can't speak to the medical propensity for intellectually disabled people. But I do know that we are working hard in schools because we likely might be seeing these children, you know, making sure that they have a really good understanding of in-person education. So we are going to be taking all the precautions and just do the best we can for everybody.
All right. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for calling in. That's Aaron Frazier, Director of Special Services with the State Department of Education. Going now to Robin, who's calling in from Camden. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question about how parents should handle the differences in how different families are handling the go back to school situation, because I know of some parents who aren't comfortable sending their kids to school at all. And how do you respond? What do they say to their kids when their friends are going back to school and they're not?
Bear, I'll start with you. Great question.
Yeah, this is something we've been talking about because Maine has such a unique population, you know, district to district. Really talking with individual districts on how they're having those conversations. How families are sort of engaging each other within the community and having some of those social conversations about, you know, why some people are returning to school, why some people are staying remote or in hybrid learning, and what that looks like. I think they're really reaching out to the local community resources or to school counselors and social workers within the district is a really good way to help drive some of those conversations. But really, it comes back to that communication about safety. And we know that, you know, I think a really important thing to mention is that our, you know, our most vulnerable populations are disproportionately affected by COVID, by the crisis, and making sure that we have plans in place to support those families as they're going through this crisis, and that they are getting the resources and support, and that those students are getting resources and support.
Well, Robin, thanks for your call. And we are going to take another quick break. If you'd like to call in, we're talking about getting kids ready, mentally, socially, ready for mask wearing and social distancing to go back to school. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage summer heat with air sealing, insulation, and window replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Storied, dedicated to capturing your stories to share with those you love. StoriedME.com.
Ian Crocker, American former competition swimmer, five-time Olympic medalist, and former world record holder, was born in Portland on August 31, 1982. During his career, he set world records in the 50 and 100-meter butterfly, long course and short course, and the 100-meter freestyle, short course. Crocker retired after the Beijing Games, having won a total of 21 medals in major international competition spanning the Olympics, the FINA World Aquatics Championships, and the Pan Pacific Swimming Championships. History will remember him as one of the greatest butterflyers, a man who held on to the 100-meter butterfly world record for 6 years.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, the COVID pandemic has disrupted every aspect of our lives and economy, perhaps none more than our food system.
Slightly more than 50% of our food dollars is spent out of the home. So when you think about 50% of the market immediately being shut down, that's a huge thing to try to absorb.
COVID and food on the next Climate One.
That's coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about the many back-to-school challenges for students and how to deal with them. My guest, Chris McLaughlin with the Northern Light Acadia Hospital, and Bear Shea with the Department of Education. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or again, quickly post to our Facebook page. Calling in now, Claire Harrington, who is a math specialist for kindergarten through second grade with the Cumberland North Yarmouth School District. Thanks for calling in, Claire. You get to work with the real cutie pies, don't you?
I do. I'm very lucky.
You teach younger kids, as we mentioned. What are some of the challenges for that age group that you think you're going to be dealing with?
I think for us, or for me particularly, I go into the classrooms a lot, and I work in some small group instruction for students. So for me, I'm used to sitting right next door to a child and helping them manipulate materials that we're using to understand the math concepts. So when I have to be 3 to 6 feet away, I'm not quite sure how to do that yet. We play a lot of games with their peers, and it's going to be really hard, excuse me, to play those 3 to 6 feet apart. And we just really have to have the materials as well. Our classrooms are not built to have individual materials for every single student in our classroom. So I could go on for hours probably with all the challenges we're thinking about.
Well, Claire, tell me something you figured out so far. What are some ideas you have that you're going to try out next week and the week after?
Well, there's a few things. One, we've sort of identified sort of the bare minimum that every child is going to need. So the kids will have some of their own toolboxes, if you will, of materials. We're sending home math kits for kids so that when we are doing remote learning, because we are in a hybrid model, that we know what they will have, so they'll be able to access any activities we send from home. And we're just talking about different ways to maybe use technology to play games from 3 to 6 feet apart, projecting games on the classroom projector to see if we can do some things that way. I think there's going to be a lot of trial and error.
Are teachers exchanging ideas? Are you reaching out to fellow teachers in other districts? Are there online chat rooms to try to figure this out together?
There is a wealth of information out there, to be honest with you. We've been fortunate that a lot of education programs and such have opened up for free use over the last 6 months, so that's been great. I'm part of a couple of different groups with the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, so there's been loads of information coming out of there. And so, yes, I've been communicating, reading, learning all sorts of different ideas that we'll be trying out in the classroom. I think every classroom looks a little bit different. We have a large school compared to some other places, so that makes a difference in how we're going to run this fall. But we're all trying it and sharing our ways to make it as best we can.
I understand you're also dealing with back-to-school challenges as a parent with a daughter starting her senior year in high school. What are the toughest aspects of going back to school for her?
Well, I think a senior year is sort of a milestone for kids, and so they look forward to certain things, you know, being the oldest in the school and spirit weeks and all sorts of things that define a senior year that are no longer going to define the senior year. Excuse me again. She can't go visit college campuses, so everything's done through virtual tours and figuring out what she might like to do that way. She's big into the theater, and they're, at the moment, not able to perform on the stage. So, and she's on the swim team, and they can't get at the pool at the moment. So, you know, there's so many things that she was looking forward to. So for as a parent, the hardest thing for me to see is the lack of excitement she has to start school.
Mm. Oh, I'm so sorry for her. Well, good luck to you as a teacher, Claire, and as a parent. And thank you so much for calling in today. Claire Harrington teaches K through 2 math in the Cumberland North Yarmouth schools. We're going to go now to Ellie, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellie. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking this call and doing this program. What I am trying to remind everyone, every parent, every grandparent, and every neighbor about is if you treat these young people with respect and give them truth, they will rise to most any occasion. They want to find a way to do the drama. They want to find a way to study journalism. They are amazing. So do ask them to be part of the conversation. Thank you so much. This is the gift we can give back to the world right now with our love and our effort. Thank you.
Ellie, thank you so much for your call. Chris, a response.
You know, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I bare started the hour by reinforcing that too, that we've really got to get kids at the table so that we have their voice, their opinions, their thoughts on how the school year should play out. And, you know, I think about what Claire was just saying about her daughter and thinking about how to do these senior year things differently. Rather than us adults try to figure it out for them, let's bring these kids to the table, ask them what is important for them, what's the experience they are trying to create, and then we can partner with them to try to make it happen.
Bear?
I think all of that really just speaks to the heart of, you know, relationship, connection, how important it is to have that open and honest piece. And I think another really important piece is to, you know, like Claire is saying, all of these asks that our teachers are taking on, you know, they're already people that are on the front line, you know, working with, you know, not enough supplies and too many kids in the classrooms. And those are the people that have really stepped up and are literally risking their health to keep our children safe and to provide them some education and really even more importantly, that support and that safety while the rest of us are trying to, you know, engage in the other parts of our lives. And I think that acknowledgement of what teachers are taking on and how important that is. And I think, you know, championing our children and taking on that. And I think championing our teachers right now are two of the most important pieces that we could be doing as a community.
Bear, I'm so glad you brought that up. Championing our teachers. What can parents do to support teachers and beyond acknowledging how tough this is?
I think really listening to the guidance that's coming out, teachers are going to be doing their very best to work within the guidance to be flexible to be able to engage with students in, you know, in new and often exciting ways. There are some opportunities that this has really provided for us as a community in Maine, new ways of doing hybrid learning and using online resources. And it's teachers are really investing. They've spent a lot of time this summer trying to get ahead of that curve. I mean, imagine any of us trying to, you know, we've all been affected. Our jobs have changed and shifted, but teachers really have to learn to do things in a totally new way while keeping themselves and children safe. And so I think any way that we can kind of go along with them, champion them, be in support, you know, what they're saying and doing, our guidance is being handed down from the CDC at the state, and they're doing their best to work within that structure to keep our kids safe.
Ellie, I want to thank you for your call. And Chris, I want to ask you about family relationships during this time. What advice do you have for, I cannot even imagine in some families, especially with many kids and many different grade levels and working parents, what kind of advice do you have for just the whole family dynamic as we all jump into the school year together?
Yeah. You know, it's about listening and communication. I think these are themes you've heard us say over the last hour or so, where I think families have to be more intentional now than ever to carve time in their schedules, as busy as they are, to have that sit down, cell phones away, TVs are off, and they're listening to each other and talking to each other. And I think it's important, as we're talking about this whole conversation with kids going back to school and teachers, a lot of families are transitioning back to the workforce too, and that's overwhelming as well. And so in this real time of emotions running high and folks are just running on empty a lot of the times, to carve out that special family conversation, listening time, let kids know that you want to know what they're thinking and feeling. It's not a time for the adults to do a lot of the talking. It's a time for adults to just listen. Create some new family traditions right now. Pizza night may not look the same on Friday nights as it used to. Taco Tuesday may not look the same as it used to. But how do we take this time and create some new bonds, some new traditions, so that years from now, when this is all in our rearview mirror, we're able to look back and say, oh, this is why we do things the way we do as a family now, because of this.
Mm. Bear, I want to bring up something we haven't talked about yet, which is screen time. Up until this pandemic, people were trying really hard to limit their kids' screen time. Now, the screen is the savior for many, many people, people lucky enough to have a high-speed internet. How do we think about screen time today?
I still think all of the concerns we had previously as parents apply. And we are in the middle of a crisis, and these are changes that we're making because of that, because it's not as easy to be in person. And so I think when we're talking about using screen time as a tool and using it to access things like support or education, I think that makes sense as a tool for what we're doing right now because of this crisis. I think the other side of that, of course, is we tend to, as we're stressed out and withdraw and pull away and turn into our devices. If anyone has their screen time enabled on their phones, I would imagine they've seen a sharp uptick in screen uses just as adults. And we know that for youth, that can be even more of a significant piece. And so just like Chris is saying, how are we putting down those devices when we have the opportunity? How are we not making it punitive, but really about this is a time we're intentionally going to connect and talk. And there are intentional places to use devices. So it's really looking at how we're balancing that out.
Chris, is there anything you want to add about the whole notion of screen time?
No, it's ironic. We talk about limiting screen time while we're on screens. We talk about monitoring for Zoom fatigue while we're on Zoom. And so, you know, I couldn't agree with Bear more. I think it's really about the quality of the screen time. The screen time I get worried about is when kids are in their rooms with the door closed at 2 or 3 in the morning. That's the screen time I'm worried about. That's the screen time I'm talking with kids and families about. Screen time at their kitchen table while they're live Zooming their school or their behavioral health or even their primary care, I take that with a very different perspective.
Interesting. Eliza on Facebook says, would you please ask about the Moose project that was just launched to help Maine teachers? Bear, is this something you know about?
Sure, yeah. MOOSE is, I wish I could remember the acronym. I'm going to get in so much trouble when I get my emails today, but I believe it's the Maine Online. I'm not going to be able to do it, but essentially
Well, you talk. I'll Google it. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. It's going to be a pre-K through 12, first quarter of all of the classes and requirements that students could use based on their grade level. It's going to include project-based, student-led, so there are things that students can access remotely, as well as teachers can provide in class. So they're all created by Maine educators working with the DOE, and they'll be available on a platform that should be easily accessed. In addition to the MOOSE curriculum, we'll also be providing a social-emotional learning curriculum that will be pre-K through 12, and we'll have an entire availability for, a full year's worth of SEL curriculum that will be free for the entire state. Those are both two initiatives that the commissioner put forward even before COVID as ways to start to look towards providing those resources across the state.
All right. Well, I found it. It's the Maine Online Opportunities for Sustained Education, or MOOSE. We'll put that on our webpage and Facebook page. And also, I ought to mention that on the Maine Calling Facebook page and webpage, the school toolkit that the Department of Education has put out, all sorts of resources on that. So people can find a lot of information, a lot more than we've been able to talk about during this hour on that. Just a few seconds left, about a minute left in the program. Chris, I want to just ask you for some final words. Give us some general words of advice as we all launch into the school year together.
You know, as cliche as it sounds, Jennifer, it's all about self-care for me. It's all about upping our game as family members, as educators, as teachers, and modeling this and teaching kids how to do self-care. The self-care we used to do isn't going to be enough, so we've got to find a new plan where we can integrate more and more of these small micro doses of self-care into our lives.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. The voice you just heard, Chris McLaughlin, Associate Vice President of Community and Pediatric Services at Northern Light Acadia Hospital. Also with us today, Bear Shea, Mental Health and School Counseling Specialist with the Maine Department of Education. A reminder, this show is part of Maine Public's ongoing Deep Dive Coronavirus Coverage with a Focus on Education. You can find more about our series on public schools in Maine and preparing to reopen this fall at mainepublic.org/coronavirus. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.